Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, we've all heard the phrase, hope for the best and plan for the worst. But what if the worst is really bad?
The worst case scenario is mayhem, death, and destruction.
Today on Inflection Point, Felicia Marcus, chair of the California Water Resources Board. Water rights have always been a point of contention, especially in states that don't have enough of it, like California. The California State Water Resources Control Board is responsible for 1.6 million acres of lakes, 1.3 million acres of bays and estuaries, 211,000 miles of rivers and streams, and about 1,100 miles of coastline. Our guest today is Felicia Marcus, the board chair appointed by Jerry Brown. Welcome, Felicia.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us exactly what the State Water Board does.
Oh, well, there's an easy question. No. The State Water Board does a whole bunch of things. There are three big chunks to what we do. One is we actually manage the water rights system of the state of California. So in that sense, the board itself acts as water rights judges, but the whole staff actually implements the water rights system, which does include Bay Delta water quality standards setting. But it's largely California's more than 100-year-old system of water rights. We run the drinking water program, the regulatory program for the state, which just moved to us last year, so that you would have one entity responsible from source to tap. And that's been a really important thing for us and will be for the coming years. And we administer the clean water programs, the clean water regulatory program that permits things like sewage treatment plants or industrial facilities, wetland protection, all of that passel of things that is the Federal Clean Water Act and the State Porter Cologne Act. And we have a unit that, a Division of Financial Assistance, which gives out hundreds of millions of dollars in grants and loans for things like sewage treatment, recycling facilities, and the like. And then this year, actually last year, because of the drought, the governor gave us an additional emergency authority to be able to do mandatory urban conservation regulations, which was something he added to our plate.
So how much total water are we talking about? Has anyone done the math on that?
You know what? People have. I think the Department of Water Resources, probably if we looked at the California Water Plan, we could look it up. The thing about how much water is an interesting question, because California has the most variable hydrology in the country, which means we have the widest swings in the nation by far between wet and dry years. So there's some years where we certainly have billions and trillions, maybe even zillions of gallons of water. And then we have years where we don't have anywhere near as much as we'd like to have, but we still have a fair amount.
What is your role as chair of the board?
My role as chair is to help set the agenda, largely to run the meetings and to be on point on issues. But it's a very collegial 5-member board and a very talented board. I can't believe how lucky I am to have such good people with really solid experience, but more importantly, a problem-solving attitude and a sense of the collective. And so we have different strengths, and a lot of times we're out giving speeches or being on point. So if you look at the 5 of us, we overlap a lot, but some folks have more expertise or interest in one thing or another, and then you'll be out there like making sure you know it, and others will look to you for guidance on tough issues.
Well, let's talk about the drought. So new rules in place. You got to ask for water when you go to a restaurant now, for example, and can't water your lawn if it hasn't rained for a certain number of days, right? Were these at your directive or the board's directive, or how did these rules come into place?
Well, two places. One is the governor decided that we had to take bolder actions or more bold actions. And so last year he gave us the authority to do emergency regulations. And we started out with what we felt were relatively light touch regulations, only because no state's ever done that. Generally, water is managed at a local level, local agencies, but we were not seeing people heeding the call to conserve in case we were in a multiple-year drought. Part of it was the El Nino hype of last year had a kind of a depressing factor on it, but also folks were hesitating because we've been in a more or less 3-year drought
it's like 3 years and then it rains for over 100 years since we started keeping records. But we know from geophysical evidence that we've had 40-year and 400-year and longer droughts. And we know that in this century, even just in the decade of the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, Australia, which had been in a similar three-year cycle for the same 120 years, went through a 10-year drought. And so we felt that we had to take greater action. And so we did these light touch regs to kind of nudge water agencies into doing what they should be doing and what they do best, which is communicate with their customers. And we did a lot of the use restrictions. We hadn't yet done the hospitality restrictions you mentioned, but things like common sense things, really. Don't water your lawn so much it runs off into the street. We really focused a lot on outdoor ornamental watering because Californians on average, and this is throughout the year, use over 50% of their water outdoors. And I don't think they really realize it. We hemorrhage water on outdoor landscapes to trick lawns into thinking they're in Ireland. And it's worked for a number of people and they like the way it looks. But when you're talking about a drought where you may be running out of water for public health and safety, economic uses and other uses, it just made sense to try and save as much of that water as we could in case we were in a multiple year drought. And of course we were, and we went into the fourth year of drought with the worst snowpack in 500 years. And so the governor ordered us to do even more and to actually give number targets. And that's what's prompted much greater action on the part of the agencies and phenomenal response on the part of the public. But we had tuned up the regulations to add the things like the hospitality restrictions, the asking for water, and being given the option of having your sheets not laundered when you're in a hotel, because it both made common sense. It's not so much the water you drink. I always say, you know, drink all you want. But it takes a lot of water to wash that glass. And it also just, every time someone goes to a hotel or to a restaurant, it reminds them that we're in a drought. And we were having real trouble with people realizing we were in a drought. Now people know, and it's at the top of people's charts. But even a year ago, they did not.
And the lawn watering, I think I misstated it earlier. It's not about how long it's been since it's rained. It's not watering it right after it's rained.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Which, again, is just common sense. But, you know, we've gotten to the point where folks have automated their sprinkling so much that they don't think about it. You know, they set the timer. And we really needed people to not do that and to be conscious about not watering when it rains. And we can sort of tell people seem to get that.
What are your feelings on this whole name and shame?
I actually have mixed feelings about it, and I think it's overblown. I think, you know, again, people are different. I tend to be more of, I hate to use water metaphor, a glass half full person. But I, from having worked in local government years ago in L.A., when I ran the Public Works Department, and we were rolling out recycling, and we dealt with that drought of the late 80s and 90s, my feeling being out in the public working with people is they really want to be part of a community, and they want to be part of a community effort. So I think folks are looking sometimes for comparison, but they look for comparison to be part of their community. And so it's not so much a gotcha game as a let me look around and see, am I in the norm, or am I a leader in my community? And that's definitely held true in a lot of the behavioral research and things like the adoption of smart meters, which about 10% of Californians now have, where it can really give people real-time information on how much water they're using, but it can all, which helps. You can find leaks, which is probably 20%, 30% in some communities, which we really, it needs to be the next frontier of what we really focus on. But it also helps you see how you're doing compared to your community. And anecdotally, and also from hearing from experts, that really motivates people, either because they don't want to be a laggard or because they want to be part of the community. But I'm not that keen on blaming in general, and I've spent a lot of time in the media trying to debunk some of the bigger blaming things, whether people are blaming an almond or bottled water or whatever else they don't like for drought problems, or even this artificial argument between urban and agriculture, which is really unfortunate, or fish and farmers. I mean, there's plenty of this happening, but it really doesn't help us get to a more resilient future.
So the artificial argument, you don't think it's that these are competing interests?
No, because I think folks will say, for example, whether you say it's 80% ag and 20% urban of the water humans take out of the environment, or you say 50% stays in the environment, and there's a whole issue there of what that's composed of, 40% is ag and 10% is urban. The fact of the matter is that agriculture, you know, farmers don't grow food so they can pile it in a big bonfire and have a party and pat themselves on the back. They grow it to feed people. And those people live in urban areas. And urban person's food water footprint is much higher than their lawn. And so that's why I think it's an artificial distinction. We can talk about how folks in urban areas could be more efficient and conserve more, but also be more efficient in how they use water. That's true. And you can say the same for certain farmers. I'm not saying that either of them are perfectly fine, but to draw those distinctions are just unfortunate. I think part of it is we're at this amazing time in human history, if you look at it some way, where at least in our large urban centers, folks can take for granted that they're going to have clean, safe, affordable water coming out the tap. If you think about that, they don't even know where the water comes from. That's a miracle. That's never happened in civilization before, really. I mean, even the Roman aqueducts, which are the forebears of all these systems, folks saw them and knew where they were and knew where their water came from. Similarly, we take it for granted we're going to have healthy fruits and vegetables in the supermarket, and we don't think about where it actually comes from. 50% of the nation's fruits and vegetables come from California because we have this perfect climate and really good soil. So again, some of those artificial distinctions and blaming I actually find very painful, and I don't find them very constructive in figuring out how we all move forward together.
It's interesting with the whole farm-to-table movement that there's not also a water source to tap movement. Like, do you know where your water comes from? Just like you'd want to know where your meat or your vegetables are growing.
Yeah. And I think
if you grow meat, but you know what I mean?
I know. I do. I do. It's interesting because it's a little bit different in terms of how you can't make choices every single day on where your water comes from, but it still seems important. I was speaking to a group of international large water agency managers, and I said, you have a lot to be proud of for all the reasons I just said. And I said, you know, I've worked with engineers in a lot of jobs, and I know they're proud of the fact that people don't have to worry about their water. And they should be, right?
Yeah.
So they haven't shared with people where it all comes from in the details. But the fact of the matter is we have to shift now back into an era where we actually share with the public the wonder of where their water comes from so they appreciate it. They're going to need to pay more for it over time because as it becomes more scarce, as climate change essentially robs us of a third of our water in the future because a third of our storage in an average year is snowpack. Few degree temperature rise, and maybe it's in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, maybe 50 years, it's gone. And we'll have more flooding in the spring, and we will be in the kind of situation we're in right now. And so our administration, before the drought, did a water action plan to say, hey, we've got this Mack truck coming at us of losing our snowpack in a number of decades. We've got to start managing water better. And that means conservation. It means recycling. It means stormwater capture, which some cities have great plans for. It means desal in appropriate. So it means managing our ecosystem sort of ahead of the curve because we need fish and wildlife too. Today, we need it all. So we got to do everything. We need more storage. We've got to manage groundwater. We got historic groundwater management legislation passed, which has always been sort of the third rail of politics. But not only the governor, but ultimately the legislature and people in the agricultural parts of the state realized we really had to do it because our groundwater basins are the only thing big enough to make up enough storage to compensate for what we're going to lose in snowpack. So,
and is the challenge on the groundwater come back to energy sources and how we're looking at things like fracking that might contaminate the groundwater, or is it a different
situation? It's a different issue. It has more to do with supply. And, of course, you know, we now have SB4, the strictest regulations in the country for dealing with groundwater contamination for fracking. And we're involved in that much more than we were in the prior system and are going to get really pretty amazing information about groundwater quality area-wide surveys before fracking happens, which will give us some really important information. So that's something that's very important. No, the bigger issue actually is just that in California, while we have a number of basins that are what are called adjudicated, they've gone through 20 years of court things to settle the rights as between the overlying landowners over groundwater, huge chunks of California weren't regulated at all. And we were actually the last state in the country, or at least the West, to actually have comprehensive groundwater management law, which puts some pretty tight time frames. Some people think it's too long, but it's actually a pretty tight time frame for local communities to come together and figure out how they're going to manage their groundwater basin, how they're going to share it, how they're going to limit it, how they're going to manage pumping so that they can get to a sustainable level over time as opposed to spending it in the wet years so you don't have it in the dry years. You've got to be putting water in the bank during the wet years. So that's going to be interesting. And if folks don't meet the deadlines in the Act, then the State Board comes in and does it for them because somebody's got to do it. So
what's the deadline?
Well, it's 2.5 years to get a group together with governance, which I think is a really hard part. Imagine a whole community mm-hmm. deciding how they're going to govern themselves on a resource like that. It's going to be hard. And then 5 to 7 years, depending on how stressed your groundwater basin is, for a plan that can get you to a sustainable situation in 20 years. Because you're not going to go cold turkey. It would wreak economic havoc. But if you look at the adjudicated basins in other parts, or the managed ones like Santa Clara Valley Water District, they figure out how to do a stair step down over time. Sorry, I didn't mean to get into the weeds, but it's huge.
It's very complicated.
Yeah, it's really important, though.
Well, I'm fascinated by where these water rights come from. You mm-hmm. talked about the 100-year history of water rights. Could you just give a very brief layman's version of how people have the rights that they currently have?
No, I can't, actually. I mean, it goes back to the mining era where they applied mining rules to water as a resource. Again, they didn't think of it the same way. It was an economic resource to be mined, essentially. And there's one set of old rights called riparian rights, which is you have a right to a reasonable amount of water naturally flowing past your land. You can't store it, you can't trade it, but that's the old riparian. Plus, they have appropriative rights. And before 1914, those are called senior water rights. Basically, all you had to do to appropriate get a water right was to tack a notice of it to a tree. It's not just the amount, it's the time, place, and method of diversion. Mayor Phelan went up to the Sierras, up on the Tuolumne, tacked it to a tree. And that's why San Francisco has such senior water rights to the Tuolumne River. Now, they're junior to two other ag irrigation districts that were there first, but they have very, very senior rights. You're the only major city with very senior water rights, and then you had to record it somewhere. Then in 1914, they created the modern water rights system where you actually have to get a permit and you can true it up to a license with us.
So the people who tagged the tree, which, by the way, made me think of licking the spoon at dinner, so you get to sit there. You know, it just seems so weird.
That's such a funny idea. But no,
but do they have to go back? The people who tag the tree, do they have to go back and get the official permits, or do they get to keep them?
Nope, it's still theirs, and they now have to give us more information about how much they use. But it's called the first in time, first in right. And the big deal, and we've implemented it beyond where it's ever been implemented in this drought because of the depth of the drought and the fact that we got some extra authority and we actually have ability to enforce now that we didn't for years, is the way you manage it is you cut off juniors in favor of seniors. And so juniors are cut off 100% in favor of the next senior guy getting 100% of what their water right is, which is why the impact on agriculture has been so uneven. So you have some folks in agriculture who are totally flush because they're so senior, and you have other people whose fields are fallow because they were junior water rights holders and they didn't have groundwater. And so you see these really harsh impacts to some that are very significant while other people look fine. So you can have a dry field next to a lush field. So when you see that picture of the fallowed fields, you know, you really actually need the cameraman to pan.
Can you fix that? I mean, that doesn't seem...
No, that's just the system we have. It's a harsh system.
Yeah. Man, get in there first. Well, let's talk about you for a bit here. Okay. So you, I'm just going to...
That's less harsh than water rights.
I'm just going to tally off the things you've done. So you've been a public interest lawyer, a community organizer, a director of the NRDC, a COO at the Trust for Public Land, and you work for the EPA.
Mm-hmm.
Did I get these all right?
That's right.
Okay. So...
Well, and I ran the Public Works Department in LA, which is the most important job I ever had. Everybody forgets it because it was a long time ago.
Thank you for bringing that up then.
No, you're getting, you know, I'm a sewer girl.
Well, what I was leading up to is that the positions that I named are all very environmentally friendly. And I'm wondering, are you, as the chair of the board of the State Water Resources Board, are you supposed to be unbiased?
Oh, that's such
or does,
a good question.
Does it affect the way you run the water board?
I mean, no, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's more who you are, I think, than your background. I mean, I have a long history of working with everybody. That's sort of my role in the environmental. I like to say I'm less of a scientist or even a lawyer, which I am, but I'm more of the ecosystem manager in the group, which is I'm all about the people and figuring out how to get them to communicate with each other, because I think a lot of times people think they're in disagreement, but they actually speak a different language or they're talking past each other. And so, you know, when I was a lawyer, virtually all my cases settled too, because it was in the interest of my clients. And I think the beauty of the board and the role is exactly to balance. And that's why I like it so much. We're not there the way the fish agencies are, you know, Fish and Wildlife or the National Marine Fisheries Service, et cetera, to protect species, or the water projects who are trying to deliver water to their contractors, which are a subset of the water users in the state. Our job is to try and maximize all beneficial uses of water, is what it said. So our job is to figure out how to find that sweet spot to do the best we can for certainly for fish and wildlife, but also for agriculture, municipal users, recreational uses, economic uses of water. So it's a great place to be because our job is basically to be fair.
Okay, let's get back to the drought. So El Nino might or might not come. What's going to happen if it does?
Thank you. Let's start there. It depends. That's the thing about it is you can't. It's all predictions. It's all predictions until it happens. Sort of like I love the Yogi Berra quote. It's hard to make predictions, especially about the future.
Yeah.
You just can't do it. But, you know, the worst case scenario is mayhem, death, and destruction. And so I worry about that. So I never say I'm hoping for an El Nino. I keep saying I'm hoping that we'll get as much precipitation as we can safely handle.
Right. Well, you were at the EPA when the first El Nino happened.
Yes.
Was it death and destruction?
It was terrible. You had flooding and people lost their property. And flooding can be quite violent, quite sudden, and quite frightening. So with that caveat about being concerned about that, but it'll happen or it won't. If we get a lot of rain, and particularly if we get a lot of snow, we will be in better shape. We won't be out of the drought because we have such a big deficit and our groundwater basins have been drawn down so severely, but we will be in much better shape. And, you know, millions of people will be in a better situation than they are today. And so we hope for every drop of that. What we really want is snow, getting back to that, because snow really extends the water in a way that is hard for folks to see. But it's like storage. It's sitting up there in frozen form, and then it melts out and refills the reservoirs and replenishes the surface waters and sinks into the ground as it does so. So that, you know, what you really want is a massive snowpack.
So it's like a natural form of storage.
It is, absolutely. If someone asked me about snowmaking, whether that was a use of water, because, you know, people were picking on bottle or the pan, and I said, no, it's actually kind of a form of storage. So it's probably a good thing.
So you're not opposed to snowmaking?
No.
Felicia, what's the best advice about managing large systems that you've ever received?
It's so interesting. And this is my bias, and it's both what I've observed and learned from people I respect, but also where I naturally go. I think it's really important to see the people. No matter the size of the institution, inside, outside, the people you deal with, I think institutions do best if you take a common sense, regular person approach to people versus thinking hierarchically or thinking about position or even thinking objectively about what it is that an institution should do. I guess my view, having come out of volunteer management where you can't tell people what to do, I think is very good experience. And so when you're trying to build an institution, you just say, what objectively is it that we want this institution to be doing? And then who are our people? What are they passionate about? What are their skills? And finding out how to tap into that and operating in that space, the sweet spot between the two, is where you're going to get the most bang for the buck. It's like in education, that you don't focus on, if the kid's good in English and bad in math, you don't just spend all your time pounding math. You also need to be spending time helping them flourish and get that confidence and go for it in English. Or I think organizations are very much the same way. And I think folks need to feel that the folks at the top care about them as people and know them as people and are interested in developing their skill set if they don't have them, but also acknowledging and seeing what they're good at.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thanks for asking.
That was Felicia Marcus, the chairwoman of the California Water Resources Board. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point, like Susan Cheney and Denise McDonald, who are helping bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you can too at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.